Can everybody, yes, I would assume everybody can hear me okay. What I want to talk about in this, my final lecture, is a little bit about the American perspective, America in Britain's place, talking about the time of Jacob's trouble, essentially the 20th century. And this is the, if the 19th century was Britain's century, the 20th century is America's century. And the period of American dominance in the world coincides with the beginning of a time when we look at the time of the end as the time of Jacob's trouble. Okay, remember, what I want to try and do is see if one can look at the Manassite origins of the United States, look at some of the differences between the British and American character, and try and look at world, show prophetic events from an American perspective to complement the British perspective that Mr. Rhodes has given. Now, Ephraim and Manasseh, remember, were taken captive among the 10 tribes. The tribe of Ephraim was in this mountainous, Can everyone hear me? This thing keeps going, you know. The tribe of Ephraim was in this mountainous region here. And Manasseh was actually split, this is quite important, was split into two portions. You had a... You had a western portion. You had a western portion next to Ephraim, where the city of Samaria was actually located in the territory of Manasseh. And these people were more like the Ephraimites in culture and thinking and background. But then you have the eastern, the Gileadites, or the eastern part of Manasseh. And they were cowboys. They were cattle raisers. They were much more rough and ready. You see the difference of the Bible between the judge Gideon, who came from the western part of Manasseh. Very tactful, very diplomatic in dealing with the Ephraimites. And then you have Jephthah, who came from the other side of the Jordan, who was much more rough and blunt and more in dealing with Ephraim. So there was a bit of a rivalry, and there were political struggles actually between the eastern and western Manassites. So it's important to remember the division between Ephraim and Manasseh, and Manasseh was divided into two tribes, taken captive separately. This group went with the tribes of Reuben and Gad. Where Reuben and Gad generally went, this half-tribe, the Gileadites, the cowboys on the eastern side of the Jordan, went with them. Where Ephraim went, western Manasseh went. And this is very important to remember when we look at the course of subsequent American history. After Israel's captivity, we find a dispersion of the 12 tribes, and you find a group of find that a lot of Ephraim and Manasseh were scattered up into Scythia, southern Russia, but particularly over here into Central Asia, Afghanistan, and places like this. You had the Dahe, they were a Scythian tribe from Tahan, son of Ephraim. There was the Bactrians, Bahri was also another son of Ephraim. You had the Amersian Sakai, descended from Machir, son of Manasseh. So there's evidence that a lot of the Manassites were here. And the Egla. Egla was the Hebrew word for bull, the symbol of Ephraim. And so you had the bull people, the Egla, would eventually become the Angli, or the Angles, centered east of the Caspian, in this region here. So we find a couple hundred years after Israel's captivity, and there are references in the book of Zechariah. People often try to argue or believe that the house of Israel, the tribes of Israel, were assimilated and destroyed after Israel was taken into captivity. But you find references. There's a reference in the book of Zechariah, I believe in chapter 10 of Zechariah, you can look it up, where it talks about, I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the bow from Judah. And it's talking about the very end, talks about having Israel's dominion from the sea to sea into the ends of the earth. It's talking about a prophecy before the millennium in a time of warfare. Talking about cutting off the chariot from Ephraim. Now, if Ephraim had ceased to exist and just been a little tribe of a couple thousand, few thousand Bedouin that had been assimilated into the Assyrians, as some organizations and some scholars teach, if the Bible is true, why do we have a reference to Ephraim? Why is Zechariah talking about Ephraim 200 years after they're taken captive? And another scripture there talks about how I would bend the bow with Ephraim and Judah as the arrow against the sons of Javan, which is a prophecy actually referring to the sons of Javan with the Greek Empire, a fragment of the Greek Empire that had succeeded Alexander. The story of the Maccabees. This was between the Old and New Testament. The Jewish people revolted from the tyranny of Antiochus. This is what the story of Hanukkah is all about. I don't want to go into it. But one of the reasons why the Jewish people were able to retain their independence between the time of the Greeks and the Romans was because they had a people called the Parthians, which I wish I could go into. Stephen Collins has a wonderful chapter in his book. The Parthians were a people descended from these Ephraimite tribes in part. And there were other non-Israelite peoples that were also Parthians who conquered, revolted from the Syrian and Greek kingdoms and conquered the whole Middle East. And Parthia was the one superpower that Rome could not conquer. For 400, 500 years, or at least 200 or 300 years, Parthia, any nation which invaded Parthia was defeated. Parthia was, as Stephen Collins points out, the forgotten superpower. And eventually, when the Parthians were overthrown by the Persians, they would migrate into Armenia. And then from Armenia, Odin led the migrations of many of these people that we see here. The Aeglai, the Emergian Sakai, many of these people gradually migrated up into northwestern Europe through Scandinavia. There was a vanguard of the Saxons in Germany, but between about 300 AD, the population in this area, these areas' coastlines are suddenly swarming with Saxon pirates. The coastline, the population of these areas archaeologically suddenly increases drastically. And the graves in Norway show a migration of peoples from the east into Scandinavia. So you have all of those tribes and peoples migrating in around 200, 300 AD into Europe. Now, of course, Ephraim and Manasseh were birthright holders. There's a very interesting view of Scripture. I wish I had a globe here, or a polar projection. I could really show this. There was a if you were to take a globe, try this as an experiment if you go home, geologists will talk about the water hemisphere and the land hemisphere. If you try to take a globe and hold that globe so that you could get as much land as possible in one hemisphere and as much water as possible in another hemisphere, hold that globe in any position, the center of the water hemisphere would be somewhere in the middle of the Pacific near New Zealand or someplace like that, but the center of the land hemisphere would be the British Isles. It's sort of a dual prophecy. Ephraim and Manasseh, let them go into a multitude in the midst of the earth or in the midst of the land. The Hebrew word Eretz can be translated either way. And in Old Testament times, that was fulfilled. But in modern times, the midst of the earth, the center of the land hemisphere, if you plot it out geographically, is, believe it or not, the British Isles. So we have a prophecy, in effect, geographically locating. It says that Ephraim and Manasseh would grow together. Let them grow into a multitude together in the midst of the earth. And then you see the separate destinies. The prophecy in Genesis 48 separates. Manasseh, of course, it says, he shall become a people, while Ephraim would become greater. And that's the way it was in the 19th century. Jacob, it says, and he set Ephraim before Manasseh. The 19th century was, as Mr. Rose pointed out, Britain's century. In the 20th century, though, it says Manasseh, he shall become great, and Ephraim will become a multitude of nations. The British Empire developed into a sovereign commonwealth, as I pointed out yesterday, in the 20th century. But it's at that point, from about 1898 on, that Manasseh became great. And after 1945, as the British Empire began to collapse, we will see the United States of America moving into the vacuum. America, since 1945, we have seen America in Britain's place. Okay, a little bit on the names Manasseh and Ephraim in Hebrew. There's a lot. The Bible is written in such a way. I mean, God preserved a record for us. And the Hebrew language is a very versatile language. One Hebrew word can have a multitude of meanings. And through this, you can, through one word, you can read prophetically, understanding it's the inspired word of God, you can prophetically see a lot of things, like the name Manasseh. Can mean causing to forget. Joseph named his eldest son Manasseh because God made me to forget my toil and my father's house. While Ephraim means restored. Also, the left hand was placed on Manasseh, the right hand on Ephraim. Manasseh was to be a liberal nation. Ephraim, a conservative, aristocratic nation. The United States basically had very little of an aristocracy. The American Constitution forbids titles of nobility. Britain, on the other hand, is very much an aristocratic nation. But the name Manasseh, causing to forget. Americans, by and large, are not a tradition-minded people, as the British are. The British approach would tend to be, this is the way we do things. This is the way we have always done things. This is the way we always will do things. And so you have, interestingly enough, and yet this gives the British, in many ways, a real flexibility. You can have a socialist. You can have somebody who is very radical in Britain, or somebody who's very liberal, very progressive, but you can have them as well giving homage to Her Majesty the Queen, acknowledging the crown. You see the strength of the British Constitution. The British Constitution operates. I don't think any other people other than the British and Australians and others can operate the British Constitution because it is based on respect for tradition. Britain is the ultimate high trust society. And the British Constitution will work so long as the British people respect and follow their traditions. And the same is true of Canadians, Australians, New Zealanders, and others. And it works very well. Of course, the Americans found, being a liberal people, turned their back on these traditions, preserved a number of them to the English common law, but Americans had to write things down as a government of law. Remember, Britain had the monarchy. In Manasseh, the most famous Manassite of the Bible was the Judge Gideon. And after the Judge Gideon had defeated the Midianites and won a great victory for Israel, and there were parallels to the Judge Gideon in World War II, interestingly enough, his name in Hebrew means almost the same as Eisenhower. The name Gideon in Hebrew, to hew down, to cut down, that's what the name Gideon means. Now, Eisenhower in German, Ike was a German-American, means hewer of iron. And iron, of course, was the symbol of the revived Roman Empire, the beast system, which came up in World War II. And Ike was the supreme Allied commander in hewing it down. And like Gideon, Ike was a poor boy, a weak farmer in Manasseh, and God jumped him to the head of this poor boy, to the head of Israel's forces. Eisenhower was a very obscure general. But General Marshall, during the Second World War, recognized his leadership abilities and jumped Ike. Ike was not necessarily a military genius, but Ike's ability to handle people was phenomenal. Eisenhower, he could get Patton and Montgomery to work together, which was not an easy thing to do, because both of them were brilliant commanders, but both of them had enormous egos. And Eisenhower had the tact and the diplomacy to handle not only them, but General de Gaulle as well. To give an example, I saw a movie on Eisenhower. This is just a bit of a digression. And Churchill and de Gaulle started trading insults. And the whole Allied cause was up in arms. And Churchill started. They started going back to the days of Joan of Arc and this whole Reuben versus Joseph antagonism. So Ike came along after General de Gaulle had stormed out on Churchill before the Normandy invasion. And it was over the issue. General de Gaulle wanted to lead the call to the French resistance. He wanted to be honored as the leader of the French resistance. And so Ike apparently went to General de Gaulle. Said, "General de Gaulle, as one soldier to another, may I ask a favor of you?" And Ike was very, that's the way Eisenhower operated. He was very diplomatic, just as Gideon. You can read of an incident of Gideon in the Bible where the Ephraimites always had a tendency to put the Manassites down. You can see that, and this is concluded even into modern times. And Gideon, very diplomatically, handled the Ephraimites. The Ephraimites were professional soldiers. The Manassites were more amateurs. The Ephraimites were professional soldiers. And after this war, the Ephraimites wanted the credit for defeating Israel's enemies. And Gideon, very diplomatically, they made some disparaging comment about Manassites. And Gideon handled it very diplomatically. A generation later, Jephthah was much more tactless. Another Manassite, the judge Jephthah, was a lot more tactless. And you had a civil war between Ephraim and Manasseh as a result. But that's just a story. I've wandered off topic, but I wanted to... The other thing about Gideon, which was very important, as a judge, they wanted to make Gideon king, like George Washington. And Gideon said to them, when they said to Gideon, "Rule thou over us and your son's son." And Gideon said, "I will not rule over you, but the Lord will rule over you." In other words, Gideon was not, they wanted to make Gideon king. Gideon was a Manassite. And Manassites generally, at least on the surface, do not put up with monarchy. Israel under the judges had a system not too different from the American system. Israel under King David had a system not too different from the British system. The only difference is a lot of Americans have a sneaking admiration for monarchy, which comes out in some of the more aristocratic. Some American presidents may be descended from the Davidic line, or at least from royal line. The Kennedys are descendants of Brian Boru, and the Kennedys were very, for the first time, in effect, America tried monarchy with the Kennedys. The Kennedys had a very monarchical, the Kennedys had class, but the Kennedys were themselves of royal descent. Ronald Reagan, apparently, Richard Nixon was apparently also of royal descent, and so was Ronald Reagan, and there were probably other presidents as well. The name Reagan, R-I-A-G-A-N, was an old name going back to Tara, where Jeremiah apparently came to Ireland. So you have some American presidents, maybe a lot of American presidents were Scottish and Irish as well of the line of Judah, but that's another aside. But you have, of course, Manasseh causing to forget. Manasseh was to be a liberal nation. Another way of translating the Hebrew for Manasseh was responsible representation. No taxation without representation. So in the name of Manasseh was contained the democratic liberal character of the American people. The same thing also with the word Manasseh, according to Talmudists. Nesher meant eagle. You know, the eagle, of course, was Talmudists assigned the eagle to the tribe of Manasseh and also to the tribe of Dan. Now, Ephraim, of course. And, of course, I just want to get back to Manasseh. That one of Manasseh's sons was called Machir, M-A-C-H-I-R. And that name can also be translated as salesman. Yes, salesman, and also as slavery, apparently. It is even possible. We know the name America came from the Italian, it was Amerigo Vespucci, who was the Italian mapmaker, and America was Amerigo's land. But where did Amerigo Vespucci ultimately get his first name from? It may have come from the Hebrew word machir. North America, the name America itself may derive from, this is according to Yair Davidi, Jewish scholar, land of Machir, firstborn son of Manasseh, son of Joseph. Now, Ephraim, of course, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. America would receive its blessings by leaving the past behind, by leaving Europe, by becoming a liberal nation. The British love old things. The Americans love new things. You put them together, they complement one another. The Americans, if the British tend to get a little hidebound, the Americans tend to be more progressive and more adventurous, more risk-taking. The difference between Canadian businessmen and American businessmen. Canadian businessmen are very cautious. American businessmen are very much risk-takers. On the other hand, the British have a sense of fairness, which, unfortunately, in America, for 50 years, because the philosophy in America was anybody could make it on their own. So you had an opposition to labor unions. You had an opposition to Social Security. You had an opposition to welfare and to health care and a lot of things that didn't come in America till the New Deal, till the Great Society. To give the difference between a British conservative and an American conservative, during the Depression, Winston Churchill was in America. And he and Herbert Hoover got together. And the subject came out to the idea of unemployment insurance or unemployment compensation. And Herbert Hoover was dead against unemployment insurance. He said, unemployment insurance destroys character and initiative. Unemployment insurance perpetuates unemployment. This was at a time when more and more people in America were becoming unemployed during the Great Depression. To which Churchill replied. And the Churchill family had always been strongly for social legislation. Winston's father, Randolph Churchill, was one of the first conservatives in Britain to advocate giving working people the vote. British and Canadian conservatives recognized labor unions. American Republicans tended to bust them and smash them until Teddy Roosevelt came along and gave America a progressive conservatism. But Churchill replied to Hoover. He said, life is difficult enough without having to seek additional trials. You see, that was the difference between British conservatism and American. British conservatism, Australians, Canadians, would tend to see that people need to have a fair go. We believe in private enterprise. We believe in free enterprise and private property. But we also believe, don't believe in throwing people out on the street. Which, unfortunately, there are right-wing elements in the United States that have that philosophy. There are some conservative elements. There are both moderate conservatives in America, but you also have some very extreme conservatives that, are much more, would like to turn the clock back to the 19th century. Because the idea was in America, anybody can find a job. Anybody can make it on their own. We're so prosperous and abundant. Plus, there is a distrust of government and authority that is innate in the American character. But getting back to Ephraim, the name Ephraim can mean doubly fruitful, restoration or restored. What happened in Britain after Oliver Cromwell? England tried a republic. Americans won't put up with anything but a republic. The British were the opposite. The British, England tried a republic under Oliver Cromwell. 20 years was enough. And they restored the Stuart line. They restored the Davidic line. You can read about the restoration in England. And again, it fits in with the idea of the conservative tradition. Also, and this is very relevant to Australians, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. That's where Joseph, when he named his younger son Ephraim, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. Australia started as a penal colony. It was a land of affliction for the convicts of the First Fleet and the Second Fleet, the people who came here, 1788, 1789. Just as Britain had been suffered through the long centuries of feudalism and everything, but Britain eventually, the nations of Ephraim, eventually became fruitful in the land of their affliction. Australia evolved from a penal colony into the lucky country, what Donald Horne talked about. Australia prospered and became much more one of the most advanced countries in the world in terms of social legislation, equality. There was far less poverty in Australia and New Zealand than many other. New Zealand is even more British than the British. Ephraimite countries. And you look, what's interesting, I wish Americans would study Canadian history more. They would understand their own national character. How much time do I have? How much? 20 minutes. Okay. So that's looking at the biblical differences. Okay, a question comes up. How, if both Ephraim and Manasseh were Anglo-Saxon peoples. How did the Ephraimites stay in England, but how did these people, when they migrated over to America, suddenly turn into Manassites? You see, how did these people turn into Manassites? The interesting story about this is that certain parts of England were descended from Ephraim. Certain parts of England and Scotland are descended from Manasseh. And the real cradle of America, the real Yankee, the Puritan New Englander, came from a region called East Anglia. So here you have London. And north of London, you have Norfolk, Suffolk, you have Ipswich. We actually have an Ipswich here up near Brisbane. I went through there. And you have this area, this pink area here in the area of Suffolk and Essex. That was the heart and core of the Puritan migration to New England. Jonathan Winthrop. And the Puritans very much, there was always a religious division between the East Angles who settled here and those Eglai migrated westward. They became the Angles from Eglai, the bull people, the Angles, as we give the name Angles. Saxons came from Isaac's sons. There was a people called the Angae with them. Dar Angae, Sar Angae. North folk, South folk. You have Norfolk and Suffolk. And about 100 years after the Anglo-Saxons came into Britain, another wave of people left Sweden, came over and settled. They were called the Ipswich people. The famous Sutton Hoo Baron. You had the whole kingdom of East Anglia. This whole kingdom of East Anglia. In this corner of England. This doesn't seem to be working very well. This corner of East Anglia, you have an area up here. Here you find in Lincolnshire. That should tell you something about a future American president. Cambridge, you had Boston. There was a city of Boston up here. There was Norfolk, Suffolk. You find a lot of these place names, Cambridge, Boston, Ipswich, Framlingham, all of these place names that you find in New England traced back to East Anglia in Britain. So what you had was in the 1630s, you had about 20, 30,000 people left East Anglia and migrated over to Massachusetts and founded from that Puritan stock came the heart and core of the United States, or at least to the English-speaking population in America. Now, what's interesting about this is you had the southern United States is actually made up of a very different... This is kind of a bit tricky trying to show these two at the same time. But this was the Manassite element in America. You have here, of course, the... I wonder if I could adjust this. It's a little bit... kind of a bit blurred. Okay, what you have here, of course, was the... have Anglo-Saxon settlements. That East Anglia, again, Norfolk, Suffolk. The Manassites coming into this corner of England. Then you have, in the days of William the Conqueror in the Middle Ages, the most densest, prosperous, free enterprise part of England. So you had feudalism in these parts of England. But in this part of England, one-third of the population in that part of England were free enterprise farmers owning their own property right in the Middle Ages. And here we have, again, this was the most prosperous part of England in the Middle Ages. Peasants' revolt in 1381, foreshadowing some of the modern times. You had, around London, you had a priest called John Ball, who was the first socialist in England. He was a priest, he was the first socialist in England. Socialism in England has rarely been Marxist and atheistic. Socialism in Britain was Methodist. It derived from British Christianity, not from Marxism. Marxism had very little appeal to the English people. England did not have a revolution like France because the Methodist Church But see, the Methodist Church taught compassion for the poor. It was a working man's religion. But you had the first priest, a priest called John Ball. This was 1381. Adam delved and Eve spun. Who then was a gentleman? But this uprising was also very strong in East Anglia. And the peasants of East Anglia went out and revolted against the king, promising a great society. That if the great society, which Lyndon Johnson would use the phrase hundreds of years later in America. And also you found that this corner of England was a very powerful stronghold of Puritanism. The difference in the Church of England, of course, was very similar in some ways to the Church of England. You subscribe to the Book of Common Prayer. Many of the practices of the Catholic Church were retained. And the Anglican Church, as long as you subscribe to the Book of Common Prayer, you could be a good Anglican. And the Anglican Church fit in with the more... It helped to a great deal to shape the English character. The Puritans, on the other hand, followed the teachings of John Calvin from Geneva. And they had a very literalist approach to the Bible. They had a very... In other words, the Puritans felt that if it wasn't found in the Bible, the Sabbath was kept much more rigorously. In Anglican community, one would go to Mass, and then the rest of the day was free. The Puritans had very strict Sunday legislation. They kept Sunday as the Sabbath. And what the Puritans had a much stronger admiration for the Old Testament and consciously identified themselves with Israel. And of course, there was tensions between the Anglicans and the Puritans, between King and Parliament, which led to the English Civil War. A number of Puritans left for America. And when they left, Jonathan Winthrop, I remember him in his departure sermon, this is about 1629, 1630. And I will appoint a place for my people Israel. He quoted the verse of the King's Psalm, but again, this reference to my people Israel. The Puritans came over to New England and started America, in a sense. But people from the southern United States, interesting enough, those who colonized Virginia and some of these southern states in the United States, came from the exact opposite corner of England, from the most English part, as it were. I've been to Oxford. You have the Kingdom of Wessex, where King Alfred lived, and area loyal to King John. And during the English Civil War, so you see the area held by the Royalists. The Puritans were strong here. The Royalists were strong in this part of England. And this area was an Ephraimite area. And you find coming over, it is likely that much of the American South is Celtic, it's Scotch-Irish, it's Judah and Simeon, but there's a lot of Ephraim in the American South. And the only true conservatives in America, in the historical traditional sense, were Southerners. You had the idea of the Southern gentleman, like Robert E. Lee, very aristocratic, very conservative, very traditional. And to this day, the most traditional part of they would talk about Tory Democrats, the conservative Southern Democrats, and the Southern gentleman. The Southern gentleman consciously emulated the English aristocrat. So you have the divisions in American history between North and South actually repeat the divisions between East and West in English history. There's a couple of very good books on this, wonderful books that I recommend. There's a book called Albion Sea by David Hackett Fisher. And he looks at the continuity between English history and American history. And there is also another book by Kevin Phillips, American political writer, called The Cousins Wars, where he shows how the English Civil War between King and Parliament. It's interesting that the armies of Cromwell, when England had a republic, they went into battle. They were centered here in East Anglia. And Cromwell went into battle against the king for Parliament, quoting the Bible. And they went into battle marching to the tune of da 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 da. Yankee Doodle was an old Puritan war song from the mid-17th century. What was that? No. James Cohen may have provided the words, but the tune apparently was much older. I'm not sure on that. I could be wrong what I'm saying, but I think I remember reading that somewhere, that that the tune of Yankee Doodle actually came, and the Star Spangled Banner actually came from an English drinking song called Anacreon in Heaven. But the important thing to remember is that the American North, where the true Manassite is, at least the half, remember the western half tribe of Manasseh, is the old Puritan stock. And this Puritan stock, you could, if you could ever see a map of congregational churches in America, it starts in New England, it goes westward across Ohio, Michigan, western New York. Here we'll look at the growth of the United States. Look at the growth of the United States. What you have, of course, those the Cavaliers, the people of Virginia, they settled in Virginia and they spread through what's called the Tidewater South, which is Anglo-Saxon. The Scotch-Irish came in and settled in Tennessee. This part of the American South is very Celtic. Some parts of the American South are much more Scottish and Irish, Protestant Ulster Irish, than they are Anglo-Saxon. I think this particular two of Alabama, Mississippi, they're very, very Celtic. The American Civil War, in one sense, was a war between Ephraim and Manasseh, but also a war between Celt and Anglo-Saxon. The Puritan stock, the Yankees from East Anglia, they colonized New England, spread to western New York. The Dutch were here. There were Germans in Pennsylvania, which I want to get back to, because the other half-tribe of Manasseh were actually German-Americans. And then the Puritan stock, you can trace them through the congregational churches. You can trace them through Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, up into Iowa. There were some in Michigan and Wisconsin, but you had a lot of Germans and Scandinavians who settled here. They went westward into Nebraska, Kansas, Colorado, and Northern California, Oregon. This whole area of the northern United States is, they're far from a majority. But there is a lot of that old Yankee Puritan stock there. And of course, America is a melting pot that absorbed many other people. Not every American is a Manassite. Likely not even the majority of Americans are Manassites. But Manasseh and the Manassite character shape the country and predominates. And of course, in the southern United States, the people spread westward after America became independent from Britain. See, what's interesting, what happened, the Americans, in effect, were, the British pretty well left them alone for a century. They're busy fighting the French, as Rick Sherrod pointed out last year. But after this happened, after the French had been defeated and the entire continent had become English, the English Parliament was one of the most corrupt parliaments of the day. King George III, the ministers he had, George Grenville, Lord North, and others, they were very corrupt. It was one of the most incompetent parliaments that England ever had. And they did not realize the Americans had been growing up for 200 years. Fully half of American history is before the American Revolution, is colonial. The Americans were trading freely with other parts of the world. They wanted to expand westward in the frontier. They were developing their own commerce and industry. Then the British Parliament came along and said, well, you colonials, we protected you. You need to pay your fair share. So here's a stamp tax we're going to put on you. And it was ruining the commerce of the colonies. We're also, we don't want the Indians to be upset, and we don't want the French Canadians to be upset. We want them to stay in the empire. So by proclamation, we are forbidding you to settle west of the Appalachians. You see, for the Americans, they felt that their liberties were being strangled. The principle of no taxation without representation, all the American colonists wanted, was the rights that Englishmen in England already had. America at this time, though, was far more democratic than England was. Maybe 1 in 20 or 1 in 50 people in England could vote, but fully 1 of 10 and sometimes a lot more people in America could vote. The American Revolution took place when the Americans sought to preserve some of the very liberties that they had. And unfortunately, King George made the same mistake that King Rehoboam of Judah made. You go back and you read the story. King Solomon was taxing the people to death, that he was conscripting them. And becoming very arrogant and abusive toward the end of his life. And then he dies, and King Rehoboam, his son, comes to the throne. And Rehoboam gets bad advice. Instead of listening to the wise senior men, he listens to the young cronies that he grew up with. And he says, I'm going to tax you even harder. My father chastised you with whips, I will chastise you with scorpions. And so that's how Israel and Judah got separate. Same thing happened in America in 1776, that the British colonies, the British Parliament persisted in not being consistent, in asserting its right to tax the colonies. And the warning that King George and his ministers were given by someone, remember Rehoboam. And so exactly what happened. Israel, at least this portion of Israel, rebelled against the house of David. Start an experiment. It's interesting historically. The Bible talks about a 7 times punishment on Israel. I can't really go into this, but from the time of Israel's first captivity, 733, 732 BC, around there. 7 times, that's 25, 20 years. Like a time is 360 years in Bible prophecy. That's, again, I can't go into that, take the time to prove that. Now, brings you to 1787, 1786, 1787, 1788, and a lot of things start happening. The American Constitution is created in 1787. Canada, around this time in the 1780s, the Industrial Revolution begins in Britain in the 1780s, doubly fruitful. England doubles in wealth and population overnight. Canada is created when the Loyalists and Tories, people that had come to the colonies recently, still loyal because they believed that freedom wears a crown. They didn't want a republic. They felt that the best guarantee of freedom was a monarchy. They were Americans in every way, these what were called United Empire Loyalists. But they felt, we want to create a new America, a British North America under the crown. So they sailed across Lake Ontario or walked across Niagara Escarpment and colonized what became Canada. That was the birth of Canada. And of course, no longer able to ship convicts to Georgia in 1787, 1788, right around the same time, any Australian knows that that was the founding of Australia with the First Fleet. The American Constitution, the First Fleet, and the French Revolution, where France becomes a republic, where the monarchy is overthrown in France, all occur 7 times. Roughly 7 times after the beginning of Israel's captivity. And the second wave, of course, of that captivity, 721 B.C. to 719 B.C., brings you to 1803. And as Rick Sherrod pointed out last year, the Louisiana Purchase, America's territory doubles. Then, of course, you have the Jubilee 50 years later, 1846, 1848, 1853. 50 years later, the whole of the land of the continental United States is rounded out. Now, what's interesting about this is the Americans, I said that the one half tribe of Manasseh were the Puritans of East Anglia. What of the other half tribe? You have the Gileadites, the people from east of the Jordan. And here's a map of Germany. And the second largest group of people to come to America and found America were, you had the Anglo-Saxons, but you also had tens of thousands of German people from the area of the Rhineland Palatinate, right in this region here. Eisenhower's ancestors were among them. Herbert Hoover's ancestors came from around this area. Many German Americans. Part of the tribes of Israel had migrated into Germany. There were East Anglians that came to the Rhine in the Dark Ages. There was a tribe on the Rhine called the Usipi. It was up a bit further north than down here. Usipi from Joseph. So there were Israelites, descendants of Joseph and Manasseh and Ephraim, that had migrated into Germany. Germany is a collection of many different peoples. There are peoples descended from Assur, the father of the Assyrians, in Trier and southern Germany. Much of northern Germany is descended from Abraham through Keturah's son Asurim, which means Assur is exalted. They intermarried with the Assyrians. So in a sense, much of what we describe when the Bible talks about Assur or Assyria as Germany. Much of Germany is descended from Abraham as well. That's why there's always been a close affinity. You've had these wars between the Anglo-Saxons and the Germans, but traditionally, English-speaking people and Germans would get along very well. It's only been, and through most of its history, the English-speaking peoples and the Germans have been allies. It's only been on a couple of occasions where these wars came about. World War I was actually an accident. Nobody really wanted a total war. I wish I could agree with that. World War II, though, was very much premeditated by a man called Schicklgruber, but that's another story. I wish I had another hour, 2 hours to go on, but in 1847, 1848, you had a famine. 2 million people from Germany. They were the liberals. They were the Democrats of Germany. Germany had a democratic revolution in the 1840s, and that revolution failed. And famine, but most of those Germans who were of a liberal and a Bible-reading disposition, who already thought like Americans, thousands of 2 million people packed up from the Rhineland-Palatinate in this part of Germany and came to America. 2 million people. And where they settled, of course, you find the American Midwest has a very strong German... This is a map of Americans of German ancestry. Less than 10%, 10 to 24%, 25 to 49%, and 50% or more. So you see Pennsylvania was the beginning of that, but you look at the American... You look at the German-Americans in the Midwest... And that's the other half-tribe of Manasseh, in my opinion, my view. And they were the backbone of the Republican Party in America. The South, in the beginning, tended to be Democrats. In the North, you had the old Puritan stock, and the German-Americans were the backbone of the Republican Party. Now the position of the two parties is shifting, and the Republican Party is becoming the Southern Party, and the Democrats, some parts like California, is becoming a Democratic state. New England is a Democratic bastion, and in presidential elections at least, the Democrats are still very strong in the North. Most of the governors in the United States, though, are just about every major state except California has a Republican governor at the present time. But here's the point that Ephraim and Judah and Simeon in the American South, but Manasseh in the two half-tribes of Manasseh in the north. At least that's my reading. That's my current belief on this subject. Of course, what about the American Civil War? You have an interesting thing that Manasseh, of course, so when you consider, when I'm trying to make the point that a good part of the United States was Ephraim. Remember, the 19th century was Britain's century. What's interesting about this is that the South, even though it joined the North in a revolt, the strongest supporters of the American Revolution were found up here in Boston. Among the American Puritans, they were the strongest supporters of the Revolution. The South was a bit more lukewarm about it. But for the first 50, 60 years, the first generation of American life, the South controlled the nation. Most of the American presidents came from the South. Slavery was considered an acceptable system. And it's only in 1860, when Abraham Lincoln was finally elected on an anti-slavery platform, that the South, for the first time, lost control of the nation. Here was the beginning of the transition from Ephraim to Manasseh. You see, the United States, in effect, Manasseh lived in the shadow of Ephraim up until 1860. What's also interesting about this, the victory of the American Revolution and the victory of the Union in the American Civil War paved the way for the further democratization of Britain. Britain, I do not believe, would be as democratic, or the British Commonwealth, as free as it has been through history, if there had been no American Revolution. Because over in Britain, you had the ruling class, and the upper classes in Britain, and even the middle class sided not with the Union, but with the Confederacy during the Civil War. They thought, well, this whole idea of a republic and a democracy, the Americans are hopelessly utopian, and as much as Lincoln is trying to fight, let's wait till this thing folds up, you see. I mean, People did not give the United States of America much of a future in 1861 or 1862. The British were actually prepared to intervene on the side of the Confederacy. General Lee sent his army, and Robert E. Lee was one of the greatest men in American history, a very admirable leader. He fought for the South, not because he believed in slavery. Robert E. Lee hated slavery, but he believed in its rights and fighting for Virginia. General Lee moved north, invaded Maryland. There was a big battle fought here in 1862 called Antietam or Sharpsburg. And the Confederate Army lost. And as a result of this, Lincoln was emboldened to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing the slaves wherever the Union armies went, which was a political masterstroke. And of course, Lincoln himself always hated slavery, saw slavery as a crime against God and man. And on the other hand, the British at this point withdrew from helping the South. That victory ensured the victory of the Union, and the victory of Lincoln and the Union in the Civil War persuaded Benjamin Disraeli and even the conservatives in Britain to pass a reform bill giving the working people of England the vote. So you see the victories, and of course, not only did America survive as a result of this, but the Industrial Revolution and America's rise to world power began once the northern states were in control. Then American industry just exploded, and by the end of the 20th century, the United States became a giant world power. I wish I had time to go into the Second World War. I wish I had time to go into how America took the place of Britain. And the American, in effect, America had an informal empire in the 20th century, sort of not a colonial empire, but informally through economics, through culture, through military alliances, the United States took Britain's place. But I'm afraid that as much as I've enjoyed speaking here, I can talk about any of this privately later if you wish to question me, but I'm going to have to break off there. I want to thank you all for giving me the opportunity to speak, and I was very happy to be able to share my knowledge with you.
Well, I'm sure we're all very, very pleased to have had the opportunity to hear from Dr. Lewis. It's certainly been an eye-opener for me, and I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, in him sharing his knowledge with us. Over this time, I was thinking while I was sitting there that I was getting so enthralled with what I was hearing. Perhaps next time we have Dr. Lewis here, and we can always hope there'll be a next time, we'll have a 9 o'clock start with a 15-minute lunch break and just go right on through. But before I introduce Melvin Rhodes to you for the last time, can I just draw your attention to the matter that you've seen a video camera working here the last 2 days. Also, we've had audio recordings being made of the presentations. It's our intention to make available to those who wish to obtain video or audio, or perhaps end audio recordings, that material. We don't know exactly the cost of that at the moment, but we can say with some confidence that be it video or audio, it would be no more than around $10, including any postage. Now, if you wish to make arrangements to accept that invitation to get a video or audio, you'll have on the back of your program a telephone number, and also there's the website for History Research Projects, and you can telephone that number and order those things. The only other thing, again, I would just encourage you to fill out those seminar surveys towards the end of this next session. Now, without further ado, might I introduce again Melvin Rhodes.
There you go. It works. Good. I just want to make a couple of things, clarify a couple of things. First of all, the chart which I gave you yesterday, at the bottom it says 7 church state resurrections. Excuse me. But that actually lists 6. And that was intentional. I meant to put at the bottom the one that is to come. The seventh one is still to come. Okay? So just keep that in mind. Also, somebody thought that yesterday I was suggesting that the British Empire was one of these seven church-state resurrections of the Roman Empire. That is not what I was saying. The British Empire, I don't believe, is included in Daniel chapter 7 because its characteristics were very different. It's not the kind of authoritarian, aggressive, all-conquering power that Babylon or Persia were. Not that it was perfect by any means. So I just wanted to clarify those two things. Also, I was asked the question this morning after the lecture I gave if I thought that decolonization could have been avoided. I don't believe it could have been, no. I believe that this was something that was going to happen. A lot of things changed as a result of the Second World War. But I do believe that it could have been handled differently. I found it interesting in West Africa. Again, let me leave you, put a map up here on the wall so you can see this. In West Africa, you see where all the red parts are, the British colonies. Most of this around here was French. In fact, even up to there was French. The French gave independence to all their African colonies, this one as well, the Malagasy Republic, on July the 1st, 1960. All except two of their territories, all of them, opted to remain within what was called the CFA zone, the Central African Franc. That's what it stands for in French. In effect, their economies were so closely tied to France that they have, in many respects, benefited from much greater economic stability and progress as a result of that. Now, Britain had a similar system going with the old Sterling area, where every country in the British Empire except Canada traded in sterling. And all the currencies, if you remember back to the 1950s and early 60s, all the currencies were tied to the British pound sterling, which gave all the countries great stability. In fact, the British had a rule before 1957 or 58 that in order to remain within the sterling area, no government could overspend. That was a pretty good rule. Gave us a lot of economic stability for a long period of time. No colony was allowed to overspend. If you remember, when Australia changed its currency from the pound to the dollar, it was $2 to a pound. Most countries did that. South Africa did that. Rhodesia did that, and so on. But they were still tied to sterling. But that whole system collapsed in the late 60s and early 1970s, directly as a result of overspending by the Labour government in Britain in the late 1960s. I worked in a bank in Britain at that time, and I remember the impact of it. There was a devaluation of the pound sterling, which impacted all Commonwealth nations except Canada, and every nation, in effect, lost 14%, I believe it was 14%, of its deposits with the devaluation. So the whole system started to fall apart. But that system could have been kept. Also, the system, the political system of the Commonwealth, where each country was intended to have a similar system of government to Britain, therefore retaining shared values of freedom, democracy, the rule of law, that could have been maintained as well by just making sure that if any country, for example, opted to become a dictatorship, could have been kicked out of the Commonwealth because we don't tolerate dictatorships. So it could have been done differently. That's what I'm saying. But maybe in light of what I'm about to say this afternoon, looking at what comes next, perhaps it was inevitable because Britain prophetically had to be weakened considerably. I want to show you here something, a map of Europe, because we're going to be looking at Europe now. A map of Europe in 1925, which was between the two world wars. I'll get my map of Europe out here. The problem with getting a map of Europe is no company seems to be able to keep up with all the changes and produce a map that is totally up to date. I think it was one of the major atlases in Britain. What am I doing here? I think it was the Oxford Illustrated Atlas of the World lost half £1 million a year or so ago over the changes in the Balkans. They had just printed their latest edition, and then there were more divisions and more new countries, and they had to throw them away to talk. But the question I want to answer this afternoon is, with the decline of the multitude of nations, and with the situation as it is in the world today, what is going to replace the Anglo-Saxon powers as the dominant power of the world? The United States right now is the world's only superpower. But will it continue that way? There has been a lot of talk about this following the problems in Kosovo and the war in Kosovo. Again, just to recap on what was said this morning and also what was said yesterday, I want us just to have a look at Revelation chapter 17. You might want to look at your chart as well. Revelation chapter 17, remember, and Daniel chapter 7 show a continuum of the fourth beast, which was the Roman Empire, right down from the time of Jesus Christ, when the Roman Empire was dominant in the world, right down until the second coming of Jesus Christ. And yet we live in a world right now where the Roman Empire does not exist. Nor is there anything quite like it. There's no empire calling itself a Holy Roman Empire, for example. It doesn't exist right now. And in our lifetimes, all we've ever known is a world dominated by one or other of the Anglo-Saxon powers, either the United States or, before that, Great Britain and the British Empire. In Revelation 17, talking about events just prior to Christ's return, it says in verse 12, "The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings." And elsewhere in Revelation, you see that the kingdom of God is established and the period of Christ's rule begins upon the earth. So prior then to the return of Jesus Christ, we see the seventh resurrection, the seventh horn, or the tenth horn, the seventh with the church, so to speak, the tenth, if you go right back to Rome itself, which will be put together prior to Christ's return. Now, all the other resurrections of the Roman Empire took place in Europe, just as Rome itself is in Europe. So it would seem as if we're looking for something that comes out of this geographical area. Now, it may be bigger. Those are questions that nobody has a definite answer to. But this is what we're looking for as the final superpower, the dominant power in the world, just prior to the return of Jesus Christ. Now, it's interesting, in the last 450 years, as I mentioned this morning, we've seen so much change. In 1558, when Elizabeth I ascended the throne, it was just England and Wales. Scotland even was a separate country. Well, Ireland, England did rule Ireland, but on the mainland, Scotland was separate. And most of Europe was Roman Catholic, and Elizabeth wanted to break with Catholicism. Spain was the major power in the world at the time. Portugal was a part of Spain. You know, you had all of this, the Holy Roman Empire, you had the Habsburgs and so on. That was the world at the time. So Elizabeth I made a decision that England needed to look beyond the seas, away from Europe for its security and for its trade, and so the British Empire spread around the world. What we've seen in the last 50 years is the reversal of that. With Britain, instead of turning its back on Europe and looking beyond the seas, Britain now, not just England, but Britain, is looking to Europe and wanting to get involved in Europe, turning its back on the possessions that it had overseas. Although it does still want to keep its military alliance with the United States, upon which it is dependent. Without the U.S., Britain would not be very strong at all militarily. So Britain has changed its foreign policy of 400 years in the last 50 years. And really, the realization of the need, in quotes, to change was after the Suez Crisis in 1956, when many people in Britain felt that the empire was finished, and so they were looking for an alternative. In 1962, President Kennedy, when he was visiting Britain, was asked by Harold Macmillan what he thought of Britain applying for membership of the European Economic Community, which had been formed in 1957 and which included just 6 countries at that time: Italy, France, West Germany, and Belgium, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands. Just those six countries formed the European Economic Community in 1957. And Harold Macmillan raised the issue of Britain joining, and President Kennedy was very keen on it, because America wanted a reliable ally within that European system that would, you know, keep it in line, so to speak. So Kennedy was for that. But President de Gaulle wasn't. President de Gaulle always considered that Britain and America acted in unison against France's interests, and so he said a very emphatic no, and Britain was not able to join. In 1967, another application was made, and again, de Gaulle said no. But like all of us, we don't live forever. He died in 1970. Britain applied again in 1971 after de Gaulle had died, when President Pompidou was the president of France, and the answer came back, oui, Britain could join. France at that time was getting concerned because West Germany was becoming too big, too powerful, too rich. And the French wanted Britain in Europe to try to balance out the balance of power in Europe so that Germany did not get its own way all the time. So on January the 1st, 1973, Britain joined the European Economic Community, which does not exist anymore, by the way. A few years ago, it was renamed the European Union, because now the intent is to create a full union, a United States of Europe, in effect, to be called the EU. So it is not just an economic community anymore. It has changed. Now, the decision to join the common market, as it was known to most people, was a controversial decision. A lot of people felt that it was not right to do that. A lot of people felt that Britain should not turn its back on the Commonwealth. It is said that the Queen, for example, kept the Prime Minister, Edward Heath, in audience for many hours before agreeing to sign the papers on EEC membership. Her main concern was the Commonwealth, particularly the effect that Britain's membership would have on Australia and New Zealand, of which she's also head of state. But Edward Heath and a lot of other people didn't concern themselves with the Commonwealth, which they thought was in Britain's past. Britain has more and more become enmeshed in Europe. Usually Britain is behind when it comes to progress toward European unity. Most of the other nations of Europe, for example, this year formed the Eurozone with the aim of creating a single currency for Europe within the next 3 years. Britain did not join it, and it's still a contentious issue, but certainly the British Prime Minister does want to join the Eurozone, and so does the ruling Labour government, the Liberal Democrats, some of the Conservatives do as well. Now Europe is set on unity in every respect. And I think it's inevitable, the path that it's on, but and you know, we can see that it does tie in with that prophecy about this final resurrection of the fourth beast. But what are the implications for this? Well, again, we need to recap on the policy changes that Britain has made since World War II. Britain, since World War II, has become dependent upon the United States for its defense. Britain still has defense forces, but by itself, it really could not do much. So it has been British policy to be supportive of the United States and to be as close to America as possible, which was not the policy back in the days when the multitude of nations was, you know, was of paramount importance militarily. Secondly, decolonization has been a policy since World War II, which has led in turn to smaller defense needs, less money therefore needing to be devoted to defenses. And if you look at any graph since 1945, Britain has spent less and less money on defense in real terms almost every time there's a defense review, every 5 years or so. The third policy change was for Britain to become a part of Europe. There's a fourth one as well, but I'll mention that later. So Britain has gradually reduced its defense expenditure and rid itself of important bases around the world, voluntarily in most cases. Britain pulled out of Singapore voluntarily, out of Malta voluntarily, out of Simonstown in South Africa voluntarily. It was not asked to do so by the nation that was the host to the British bases. Now, so Britain became increasingly reliant on the US. Now suddenly, as a direct result of Kosovo, there is a realization, apparently, on the part of the British government, that Britain cannot rely on the US anymore. And there's a realization of that amongst other European nations. So what is Britain now doing? Tony Blair is proposing that the EU become a military power. Now, I find it very interesting that many times in the past 30 years, Britain has been the one to really move Europe forward, not realizing the implications of this. For example, I mentioned there were six countries in the original EEC in 1957. When Britain joined in 1973, two nations that did a great deal of trade with Britain also joined, Ireland and Denmark. Norway was going to, but when they had a referendum, the people said no. That's happened twice, actually. The Norwegians have voted no. Now, because Britain joined it, some of the other countries as well had their interests sparked. They were members of a European free trade area, of which Britain was the biggest trading nation. So they also got interested, and gradually you had others like Spain and Portugal, Greece joined, and some other countries as well, which didn't even exist back then, so you can't see them all on the map. Anyway, so gradually it's gotten bigger and bigger. Also, interestingly, this is an interesting development as well, and something which a lot of people are not aware of. I need to show you another map here. I think this is of great importance, and the implications of it are quite profound. After Britain joined the European community, European Union, the former British colonies who had been trading with Britain in the imperial trading preference system asked also if they could join the Lomé Convention, as it became known. Lomé was the capital of Togo, right there next to Ghana, between Ghana and Nigeria. It's a very nice city, Lomé. And delegates from all over the Third World, the former colonies, mostly of France and Britain, so that is colonies, former colonies in the Caribbean, in Africa, all those nations in Africa, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and so on, all these nations met in a place called Lomé, and they signed an agreement which tied them all to the European trading system. Now, specifically excluded amongst Britain's former colonies were Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, because they had reached a stage of development which was considered, it was considered they were on their own. They didn't need to be a part of this trading system. But they were deliberately excluded. So Australia and New Zealand, in particular, lost out. Canada not so much, because it was trading more with the United States. But two agreements were signed in Lomé, which bound all these nations closer. So in effect, Britain handed over to the Europeans most of its empire, its former empire, as far as trade is concerned, which is incredible. But that's what happened. I forgot what I was going to add there. But anyway, that's what took... Oh, the French. The French already retained control of most of their African territories after independence because they had the Francophone zone, as it's called. And you could go... Even when Ghana had its economic problems, when it collapsed economically, and Nigeria had all its problems, you know, you could go to any of those French countries and buy whatever you wanted, because they had real money. Their currency can be changed into French francs and in turn to American dollars, Canadian dollars, or whatever. So those countries have remained economically quite viable in the main. They've had some problems, but they're quite viable. But now all these other countries have been added to the system as well. Now, what many people don't realize is that the euro is not just for Europe, but all these countries will also be tied to the euro, the former French colonies. And even the former British colonies, if they want to, in time, could join that as well and be tied to it. So we are not just talking here about a European Union. When it comes to trade, we are talking about something that extends throughout Africa, throughout the Caribbean. There were even talks just last week between representatives of the EU and Mercosur, which is a big common market down here, to try and establish some close tie between the two. Now, do you see what's happening here? Now, Britain is within Europe now as a trading nation. But the nations which are increasingly excluded from all of this trade are the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. And it's also interesting to me that whereas for most of this century, the countries that are colored red there, the Dominions and Britain, were together in one trading system, and therefore, when threatened militarily, could act together without conflict. Today we have a situation where Britain is within the European trading system, America and Canada are in NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Area, Australia and New Zealand are looking to Asia. So we are actually in three different trading systems. And in the event of conflict, as there was, say, in 1939, it would be absolutely impossible for us to act together, to act in concert, as a result of the fact that our trade is so different. Now, some of you might feel, well, trade doesn't really matter, you can still go to war. But let me give you an example of this. In World War II, let me move to another map here to show you the situation in World War II, which, as you know, began in 1939. And I have a map here of Europe in 1942. Okay, and you'll have to keep in mind the map that I've just taken off the screen of the rest of the world. But let me get this right. No, that's not right either. Okay, is that right? The other way around. Flip it over. Okay, is that right now? These countries are always moving. You see here, this was the Third Reich at its height. This was the sixth beast. The fourth beast, the Roman Empire, but it was the sixth resurrection of the church-state empire. You can see the borders, the red line going around there, okay, the red dotted line. That was the Third Reich, well into Russia. Just incredible how big it became. What limited the capacity of the Third Reich, or the ability of the Third Reich, to take over the world was the fact that Britain was still the world's biggest trading nation at the outbreak of World War II. Spain and Portugal down here were fascist countries. They had fascist dictators. Remember, Hitler sent troops into Spain during the Spanish Civil War between 1936 to 39 to fight the communist republicans who were being backed by the Soviet Union. And yet when war broke out between Germany and Britain, Spain did not go to war on Germany's side against Britain. The reason why? Because Spain did far more trade with Britain than it did with Germany. And if Spain had gone to war with Britain, it would have slit its own throat, so to speak. Portugal as well did far more trade with Britain than it did with Germany. Now, thinking back to the previous map, most of the countries in South America at that time were also fascist dictatorships. Yet not one of them supported the Third Reich during World War II, because they all did more trade with Britain and America than they did with the European countries. Most of the colonies around the world, the British colonies, well, all of them, in fact, did more trade with Britain than they did with any of these countries. So it limited the ability of some of these countries, you see, to act, to follow their heart, so to speak. And they had to follow their wallets, and they had to, act accordingly. Now all of that has changed, because the new Europe is indisputably the world's biggest trading system. Now, the United States is still the world's biggest single trading nation, but only just. The Germans are very close behind, just Germany by itself. In fact, they may even have taken over in the last couple of years because America lost out on a lot of its overseas sales to Asia as a result of the currency crisis in Asia. So Germany could actually now be the world's biggest trading nation just by itself. Now this is not... It doesn't bring us right up to date, this, but it is a map of Europe in the Cold War. Okay, this is Europe in the Cold War. There again you see the division between the Soviet communist system to the east and the Western capitalist system to the west. That, of course, is gone now, and the new Europe has extended itself. All of Germany now is in the European Union. I don't have a map of the European Union, unfortunately. But all those nations are in the European Union. Austria is as well. Switzerland is surrounded by European Union countries. Sweden, Finland are in the European Union. Greece is in the European Union. It is the world's biggest trading power, by far and away. If all of this, if the European Union united tomorrow, it would be the world's number one superpower, because it has a bigger gross domestic product, bigger gross national product, bigger trade than America does, much higher population, greater wealth. The only thing that holds it back is the fact that the nations that are members still are not a total union. But the intention and the reason for the name change is to create that total union. The euro, the currency which is going to replace the individual currencies of all these different countries, The euro is a very big step forward. Now, the euro hasn't got off to a very good start, but keep in mind, America right now is running a trade deficit of $20 billion a month, roughly, and Europe has a trade surplus, which means eventually, at some point, the euro will go up in value while the dollar goes down. Now, all kinds of factors are involved here, but, you know, don't rule the euro out at this stage. And even if the euro did collapse, it could be replaced by something else. So it doesn't mean anything in itself. But, you know, these nations have the potential to be the world's biggest power. Now, Kosovo, this problem here in the Balkans that we've just had the last few weeks, brought out a major problem, which Europeans are shocked at, and that is the realization that although the United States is willing to go to war, it doesn't want any of its troops to die. That was the case with this conflict in Kosovo. And so there was a reluctance on the part of the President of the United States to actually get involved in a conflict. And, you know, that, of course, dragged the whole thing on longer and made it a lot worse. Now, there's also frustration in the United States that America has to send troops to Europe to deal with what looks on the map to be a minor problem. Why can't the Europeans do it? Anyway, as a result of all of this, the very day that the Serbs surrendered, the Secretary General of NATO announced that he was resigning with American support. He's actually Spanish, a Spanish national. But with American support, he's resigning, and he's going to be the European Union's guy who brings their militaries together over the next 12 to 18 months. So now Europe has one supreme military commander with the intent that Europe will take over much of the defense roles that the U.S. has had in the past, which, of course, is a two-edged sword because it means Europe becomes more powerful defense-wise while America is actually cutting its defenses. It's early days yet to see what would happen, but these are interesting developments that are taking place. Additionally, you've got both the French and the Germans talking, and the Italians especially, talking increasingly about the need for these nations to come together politically, totally politically, with just one central government. The French and the Germans want that. The French want to lead Europe. They want to dominate Europe. Genesis 49 suggests that they won't. If I can just read that for a moment. Genesis 49, talking about Reuben, suggests that they won't. It says that Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, the beginning of my strength. We heard about that earlier on. The excellency of dignity, the excellency of power. Unstable as water, you shall not excel. The French tend to, you know, go backwards and forwards regarding certain things. And they will not excel when it comes to the European Union. The dominant power in the European Union, especially since the end of the Eastern Bloc, is Germany. Suddenly Germany went from about 60 million people to almost 80 million people. And it's right in the middle of Europe, and it is the biggest economic power. It's the country that all of these nations trade more with Germany than anybody else. I traveled last summer in Austria, Slovakia, the Czech Republic, and Hungary, and I found everywhere I went, when I turned on the TV set, every channel, except maybe one or two local channels, was in German. You know, because the Germans are the ones who travel around there the most, also the businessmen that are in the hotels the most. So naturally, the television stations that the TVs are tuned into reflect that. And all these nations do more trade with Germany than they do with anybody else. Even Russia as well, more trade with Germany. And Russia also has borrowed more from German banks than from anybody else. Of course, that's a negative as well, because it does mean if Russia defaults, that these countries, especially Germany, could lose a great deal. So the European Union is coming together. These countries up here, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, all want to join. Poland wants to join, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary. While I was in Hungary, front page on the newspaper, we want to join Europe. The Hungarians, you know, are unanimous pretty much about joining Europe. And interestingly, because of these wars in the Balkans, now the Germans have come up with a plan that all these new nations in the Balkans that have come into existence with the collapse of Yugoslavia, all those new nations now can become a part of the European Union. Now, this is an interesting development because what we are seeing in the European Union is that every single little country, every little tribe, if you like, in Europe can have its independence and still be a part of this bigger economic system. So there's no reason anymore for people, for nations to stay together. So, for example, you can look at Yugoslavia, for example. All those countries were together from 1918 right up until this decade. And then in this decade, it's fallen apart with Croatia and Slovenia and Bosnia and so on, each going its own route. And each of those now can be a part of the European trading system, so they get the benefit of being something bigger, but they can also be a little country by themselves. And they could even be a part of the European military system as well. Interestingly, even here, even in the United Kingdom, we see the effect of that. Because, you know, the Scots, those who want independence, talk about independence within Europe. So they can be an independent nation, some want a republic, some want to maintain a link with the crown. They can be an independent nation, and they can be a part of Europe, and they don't have to worry about England anymore. They don't have to depend on England anymore. One nation that has done extremely well out of European membership is the Irish Republic. It has grown economically, I think, more than just about any country in Europe. So the Irish Republic, which was dependent on Britain for most of its trade before 1973, now finds that it's not dependent on Britain at all. So, you know, it's very happy with that situation. And it gives it more freedom of maneuver when it comes to the problems in Northern Ireland. It no longer has to concern itself with the trade that it does with Britain. So it's changed everything, and Scotland is hoping for the same. Now, prior to Elizabeth the First time, or right up to Elizabeth the First time, Scotland and France were often in alliance against England. So, you know, the situation, if England pulls out of Europe, and you've got about 50% of the English people would like to do so, if England pulls out of Europe, England in effect will be surrounded by this European Union. A total reversal, you see, of, you know, the way things have been. We've gone full circle, in effect, since the time of Elizabeth I, right up until the time of Elizabeth II. Full circle. Now, realizing that the United States cannot be depended on to the extent it did before, Britain is now looking for closer military ties with the rest of Europe. Britain is increasingly getting more and more tied in with the European Union. Hosea, I think it's chapter 12, is interesting in this context, because in talking about Ephraim, it says, Ephraim feeds on wind and follows after the east wind. You know, all of this is east. He daily increases lies and desolation. The British really are deceiving themselves into thinking that this somehow is a better alternative to the Commonwealth and American ties that they had right up until this time. Because if they knew their history, they would know that this is not a better alternative. And there are dangers inherent in becoming a part of it. It says they do make a covenant with the Assyrians, and oil is carried into Egypt. We've heard of Assyria as the ancestors of the Germans. You know, the British have made agreements with all these nations, not just the Germans. And, you know, there's increasing trade going in that direction, and the Middle East and so on. So the fourth policy change then since World War II that I was mentioning Britain has embarked upon is devolution, which could result in Wales now with its own parliament and Scotland with its own parliament breaking away from the United Kingdom. Wales less likely than Scotland, but Scotland, of course, has had a boost to nationalistic feelings with the return of the Stone of Scone to Scotland. And I noticed a book on Friday in one of the bookstores here, which I hadn't seen before, written by the descendant of the Stuart line, who I believe now lives in Switzerland, who is getting his book ready so that he can make a claim to the throne of Scotland, going right back to 1688, when he was removed by the forces of Prince William of Orange and sent into exile. So he's trying to get back his throne in Scotland. There's a lot of other kings, by the way, trying to get their thrones back down here. Everybody's getting into the act. Prince Alexander of Yugoslavia is trying to get his throne back. Prince Leka of Albania, who lives in Johannesburg right now, wants to get back to Albania. Montenegro is talking about getting the descendant of its king back. Romania, King Michael's been there 3 or 4 times. Now, all of these countries are republics, but there's a lot of people within those countries who would like to have a king back. And what is interesting is Spain in 1976, I believe it was, after General Franco died, Franco prepared Juan Carlos, Prince Juan Carlos, who was the grandson of Spain's last king, Alfonso, to take over Spain when he died. And a lot of the fascist supporters of Franco thought that a king would be a fascist like them, and they were surprised when they tried to get rid of democracy in Spain. The king stepped in and preserved democracy. Many of these Eastern European nations have, they've got fledgling democratic systems that aren't working very well, and there's a great deal of corruption right at the very top in those countries. And so some of the people in those countries, are thinking that they could do the same as Spain and have a king like Spain's, and have a system like that, political system like that, a constitutional monarchy, in effect, where the king would protect democracy against the corruption of the politicians. So that's another possible development. In fact, in that context, if you think about it, it does say in Revelation 17 that 10 kings have not received their thrones as yet. It could be literal kings. I'm not saying it is, but I'm saying it could be. But it could also be prime ministers or presidents. A king in the Bible just could be symbolic of any leader of a nation. So it doesn't have to be kings. But if you wanted to bring all these nations together very quickly, the best way to do it would be to bring back the old monarchies of these countries, because they're all related to each other. So those nations could easily come together as some sort of a family union. Of course, on the reverse side, the First World War has been described as a family squabble. So, you've got that reverse side to the coin. But, most of the royal families here are of German descent. In the 1860s, 1870s, when the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, which ruled right up to here, when it was collapsing and each of these countries was coming into existence, they all wanted their own king. And at the same time, Germany united in 1870-71. And so Germany suddenly had, I think it was 360 royal families that didn't have any jobs to do, because Germany was united under the Kaiser. So they were all looking for jobs, they were looking for kings, so they naturally went to Germany, and it was said that Germany's biggest export in the 1870s was royal families who moved to some of these countries. And of course our own royal family in Britain is German too, the House of Hanover, going back to 1714. They didn't change to the House of Windsor until 1917, during the First World War, when anti-German feeling was at its height, so the name was changed. I might just mention also in this context that talking about Scotland breaking away from the United Kingdom, which is being talked about in the British press, it's not imminent, but it is being talked about. In this context, I'd like to quote from Paul Johnson's book, The Offshore Islanders, because in giving an overview of British history for the last 2,000 years, he makes the following statement: disunity has always been fatal to the offshore islanders, to the British. When the island is disunited, then it's very easy for other powers to come in and take over. So that's the point that he's making there. And historically, that has been the case. Disunity, of course, led to the Norman conquest. Disunity previous to that led to the Vikings coming in from Scandinavia. Disunity 2,000 years ago led to the Romans coming in. Disunity in the 1600s led to Prince William being able to come over, although most people were thankful that he did, and nobody died in that invasion anyway. So I think somebody broke his leg. That was about it. Now, how could all these nations come together? Again, look at Revelation chapter 17, where it talks about these 10 kings. I need to check my time here as well. 4:15, Revelation chapter 17. The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. Now, if they receive their power in 1 hour, that's a short period of time. Now, a day, 1,000 years is as a day to God, as we heard yesterday. So an hour, I don't think we should read into that exactly an hour, nor should we be dividing a day up into 24 and figuring out exactly how many years an hour is in the context of one day being 1,000 years. I don't think that's what it means. John, in his vision, saw this happen in an hour. So it was a short period of time. That's the point here. And these 10 nations, these 10 nations have 10 new governments, 10 new kings, and then they give their power to the beast. Now, this is interesting to think about. Europe, the European Union, has been created in a very different way to the United States that was brought together over 200 years ago. Now, a lot of people, when they think about prophecy, they think, well, you know, we've heard all this before, it hasn't happened yet. Because many people have been talking about Europe uniting ever since the last time that Europe was united and the Third Reich collapsed, and people looked at their Bibles and could see that there's got to be another resurrection of the Roman Empire. So people have been talking about this for over 50 years. But some say, well, it hasn't happened yet, so it's not going to happen. But the problem is that most of us today think more like, say, America or Australia, the new countries, where things can be done very quickly, particularly in the United States, where government has very little say in things. But Europe is very different. To use an analogy, Europe is like a citadel, whereas America is like a caravan. Americans, you know, will build a great city like Detroit, for example. They get everything they can out of it for 50 to 100 years. Then things start going wrong, so they leave Detroit and move out to the suburbs. I use that as an example because that's where I live. And so then Detroit is left just to decay and fall apart. So Americans are like a caravan. They can move. They can keep moving because they've got a big country with lots of space. Europe cannot do that. Europe is like a citadel. Whenever they plan ahead, they have to build something solid, something that is not going to be moved because there's no space to move from A to B. There's no breathing space. Remember, Hitler wanted Lebensraum, living room, living space, when he started sending his troops out everywhere to acquire territory. So Europe's very different, and the European Union has been built like a solid European castle with, you know, these heavy, solid stones building the foundation, and then the walls, thick walls. That's the way Europe has been built. And it has taken a lot of time. When I went away for a weekend recently to do some television programs in Chicago, and before I left, we had a farm just on the corner on next to the street where I live. When I came back, it wasn't there anymore. They put up this huge house there, or huge housing estate, just in a few days. It was that quick. That's the way people can do it now. But Europe is not like that, you see. Europe takes time to build, and it's taken a great deal of time to build this. In 1951, I believe it was, just Belgium, Holland, and Luxembourg formed the European Coal and Steel Community. Then once they had got their act together, as far as their economics went, then they expanded to include France, Germany, and Italy. And then again, in 1973, they expanded to include the United Kingdom, Ireland, and Denmark. And then later on, 81, I think, it was Spain and Portugal, or maybe it was Greece. I've forgotten who came first. And then later on, Austria was added, Sweden was added, Finland was added. Gradually, the European Union has been built up, you see. The colonies in the Lomé Convention in Africa and Asia were added later on. And again, it took time to absorb them, and it was done progressively in stages, with tariffs being lowered gradually each year. Everything being controlled carefully by the politicians and the bureaucrats in Brussels, because that's the European tradition, central control. It's not the British tradition, it's the European tradition of central control from the top. And that's the way that it's been done. The euro, for example. Here, there are now 15 countries in the European Union. The euro has been adopted by 11 of those countries. The countries that have not adopted it are the United Kingdom, Greece, because Greece is not ready. Those two countries haven't adopted it, and, you know, I've forgotten who the other two are, but anyway, I believe it was Sweden was one. Anyway, 11 countries have adopted it out of 15. But you see, they're doing it gradually. Now, in West Africa, when they changed their currency in Ghana, it was done within 2 weeks. And in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, it was done the same period, I think about 2 weeks. In Zambia, they changed the currency, it was 2 weeks, literally. Why is it taking the Europeans 3.5 years? Everything's done very slow to make sure that the people get used to it and to take care of any problems that might be there. People need time, you see, so they're taking a lot of time. Of course, the European Union is much bigger than a country like Ghana or Zambia or Zimbabwe. Now, the creation of the euro gives a clue as to how this might be fulfilled in Revelation chapter 17. Because it says that these kings have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. What would fit in with this description here? is that 10 nations in Europe, the most committed nations to the European Union, which would exclude England, and England always comes along later whenever anything is done anyway. So exclude England, exclude Denmark, which tends to often side with England. You can speculate on the other countries, but 10 nations decide that they are going to go ahead and have a full United States of Europe, a full European Union with just one central authority, so with one president. Then a decision would be made, well, the way to achieve this is each one of the 10 nations needs to elect another government, and then those 10 governments will then elect the one supreme leader over all 10. It would fit in very well with what's been done with the euro, and it would fit in with what the scriptures say as well. Now, maybe it'll happen some other way. But again, everything is very carefully planned. But it also means that right up until this point, Europe would retain a democratic system, which is actually an essential requirement of being a part of the European Union, and of NATO, for that matter, although exceptions have been made. So each of these nations then, France and Germany would definitely be in it. I'm sure Spain and Portugal would. Italy would definitely as well. The Benelux countries, Belgium, Holland, Luxembourg. So you've got one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight there. Austria would be in it. That's nine. I don't know. The tenth one could be anybody. But there's another thing here that also comes into this. And we'll have a look at that in a moment. But those 10 nations then will decide this is how they're going to do it. Have an election to choose a new government, which then becomes a part of a federal Europe, and they then choose the one supreme leader over all of them. And then afterwards, things go wrong. Afterwards, it would take on some of the characteristics of the Roman system. Maybe something goes wrong in the United States or Britain or whatever, and these nations then have to act, and their democratic traditions, threatened by whatever is taking place, are dropped, and they revert more to type as they have been historically. That's a possibility. There's another thing here too. Daniel chapter 2, if we just turn back there, in talking about these 10 kings at the time of the end, says this: the fourth kingdom in verse 40 shall be strong as iron. Back to the Roman Empire again. For as much as iron breaks in pieces and subdues all things, and as iron that breaks all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas you saw the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. There shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as you saw the iron mixed with miry clay. So there's strengths and there's weaknesses. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. Now, I don't know how far this is meant to be taken, but, the toes of the feet, well, most people have 10 toes. If you don't, you're unusual. Most people have 5 toes on 1 foot, 5 on the other. It is possible that it's talking here with these 10 kings that you're going to have 5 nations from Western Europe and 5 from Eastern Europe. The iron, the strong economies, mixed with miry clay, the weak post-communist economies. This would also tie in with the fact that Europe has, of course, basically been divided into two ever since the time of the Roman Empire, when Emperor Constantine, who started this imperial church-state system by converting to the new religion in 313, when the Emperor Constantine became emperor, he moved the capital from Rome over to Constantinople, named after him, now Istanbul. And when the Roman Empire in the West collapsed, you still had the Roman Empire in the East, Byzantium, which continued to 1453. In 1054, the nations of the East broke from the Catholic Church and formed the Orthodox Churches. So you've had this division of Europe all the time, basically, over the past 1500 or more years. So there is some logic in this regarding the 10 toes, that 5 nations from the East, 5 from the West would come together. Which means then, which raises the question, which 5 countries from the West? Well, it doesn't have to be 5 countries necessarily, because you could actually have, before that takes place, some of these countries become one anyway. So you could actually have, say, you might have the Benelux countries, for example, just become one, or maybe these countries, the original members of the European Union, decide to become one, and then later on, when the full 10 nations come together, Spain and Portugal, and maybe Denmark and Sweden, plus that big one, are the 5 in the West. All kinds of computations are possible. And I always get very disturbed when I find people predicting exactly which countries are going to be involved, because there's no way you can know. I think logic dictates that the Italians will be involved, because if it's to be a resurrection of the Roman Empire, you know, Rome is down there. But Germany also, because it is the dominant nation and the central nation of Europe. France, because it is so concerned to make sure it hangs on to Germany so that Germany doesn't turn against France. You know, the French have a saying, every time the Germans unite, they arrive in Paris. And they united in 1990, so the French have been very concerned. It's a serious concern, the French have. So they want to make sure that Europe succeeds. In fact, Helmut Kohl's autobiography, our minister in Germany was telling me this last year when I was over there, that in a Helmut Kohl's biography or autobiography, one or the other, it is brought out that when the Germans wanted to unite after the fall of communism, they sought French cooperation. And the condition the French placed upon it was that the Germans would cooperate in uniting Europe through the Euro. So the French are getting what they want through the Euro. The Germans got what they wanted through German unification. So anyway, we have gone full circle from an England that wanted to extricate itself from European entanglements, except whenever it felt threatened by Europeans coming together or one nation becoming too dominant, to an England that is now a part of the European Union and getting itself more and more involved in it as this final, hopefully final, resurrection of the Roman Empire comes together. So I think we can see history is, as I said, gone full circle, which brings us back to what Cicero said. You know, if you don't know what happened before you were a baby, you'll remain a child the rest of your life. And I believe that much of this has happened, and much of what has happened in America and Australia and Africa and so on, is partly the consequence, in fact, largely the consequence of the failure to teach our children their own history. And so many mistakes have been made, and those mistakes will continue to be made. It's important to remember, when we consider the blessings and cursings of Deuteronomy 28, that we will only have ourselves to blame, because our nations have turned their backs on Almighty God. We've sown the wind, and we'll reap the whirlwind. Any questions? Yes. I don't mind your ideas at all, by the way. I mean, I don't claim to know everything about all of this or what's going to happen in the future, by any means. I think there's a lot of different ideas. When I think about the New World Order, I ask myself, you know, exactly what is it? And it seems to me that one thing it is that Britain and the United States are trying to preserve, through the United Nations and now NATO and the European Union, they are trying to preserve the world order that they created after the Second World War, because the United States and Britain can no longer control events all over the world because they're not powerful enough to do so. And so they're doing it through other agencies. But in attempting to try and preserve, for example, independent countries like Kuwait and trying to preserve the borders of nations, as in Kosovo, etc., you know, a lot of that has to do with a desire just to put the lid on Pandora's box, so to speak. Because, you know, if we allow a major development, which is against our interest, to take place, the whole deck of cards will come collapsing down. That's just one thought there. But, you know, everybody has different ideas on these things. That's fine. Yeah.
In Revelation 17, it says that the
Well, it could be, yeah, that's true. Jesus is crowned before he returns, so it could be, yeah. I mean, the time of the day, you know, the hour of this, we don't know. I mean, when you think about it, we saw how the prophecies showed that Britain would rise to a multitude of nations. The prophecy was given, you know, 3,000 years or so, even more, before it actually came to fulfillment. And we saw as well how, you know, because the people would turn away from God, so they would lose all of this. It's taken 50 years for that to be dismantled. It might take 50 years for this to come together, as it says here in the scriptures. And, you know, so we shouldn't plan as if this is going to happen next year. Anybody else? Yeah, the gentleman at the back. I can answer that. The interesting thing is the nations which are most enthusiastic about the euro are the smaller nations of Europe, smaller in the sense of being less powerful. For example, Portugal, Spain, Italy is probably the most enthusiastic. The Benelux countries, Belgium, Holland, Luxembourg, are very enthusiastic about European Union. So is Greece, but it didn't qualify to join the euro. Because all of these nations, Ireland too is very supportive, all of those nations have gained considerably from being a part of the European Union. The countries that are less enthusiastic about it, the people, that is, the people who are less enthusiastic, are the Germans, the French, and the British, for various reasons. The Germans feel that everything that's done in Europe, they have to pay for, because they're the richest country in Europe. They are net contributors to the European budget. So Germany actually loses being a part of the European Union. So does Britain. Britain has lost ever since it joined. Every single year it puts more into Europe than it gets out of it. Mrs. Thatcher made an issue of this and made Britain very unpopular, and the European Union started handing back a certain amount of money each year, but I think that agreement has come to an end now. The French, you know, I'm not too sure what the percentages are in France of support regarding the euro, probably rather ambivalent, you know, the British and the Germans in that sense. The British, I was surprised, last September I went on this tour of these nations in Eastern Europe, Central Europe, and this was something that was arranged from my hometown in England. My parents arranged the trip, and everybody on the bus was from the eastern part of England where I come from. So, you know, this was the first time really in many years that I had a concentrated dose of British opinions on Europe, because everybody was commenting as we drove around. The overwhelming majority of people on that bus, about 40 people, were in favor of the euro. I was surprised, because I thought that most people in Britain were against it. Now, the most were in favor of it, but when I got to talking to them, they were in favor of it mostly because every time you go from one country to another in Europe, and now there's no borders, by the way, you don't go through borders when you go through these countries now, but every time you go from one country to another, you have to change your money, and you lose like 3% in commission every time. So they're looking at it purely from that angle, that if we have just one currency, we save all that money. You cannot imagine what a nightmare it is, if you've never done it, to have to go to the bathroom, as the Americans say, or the toilet, anywhere in Europe. Because, you know, you get off the Channel Tunnel in France, you have to pay, by the way, to go to any rest area on the expressways. So in France, it's, I don't know, 25 centimes or whatever it was. So you've got to get your money changed to go and use the facility there. When you cross the border into Belgium, you've got to change your money again to go and use the facility there. Cross your border into Germany, you've got to change it again. It's very frustrating. And if you want to go in a hurry and you've got to line up and change your money, imagine how difficult it is. So it's a lot easier if we all use euros, you see. And of course, American tourists want this too, because they could then arrive in London and travel all around Europe and just use one currency. So a lot of people are in favor of it. But there's also a lot of people in England against it. And the European election, the European Parliament elections a couple of weeks ago showed, if anything, that more people in England are against it than for it. But Tony Blair is for it. And Britain has only ever had a couple of referendums. One was after it joined the common market. Harold Wilson then came to power, and he decided to hold the referendum just to make sure that the British wanted it. And it was worded in such a way that they voted yes. And the vote on devolution, whether to establish a separate Scottish and Welsh parliament, again, it was worded in such a way that it was voted yes. You can always word a referendum in a way that gives you the vote you want. And that's the European experience anyway. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Partly, I think mostly, though, it's just the fact that when everything started, so to speak, it started in, you know, in this area, the Middle East and Europe, you know, that was the known world, so to speak, of the ancient world. There was, of course, a civilization in China and, you know, in the Far East, but the contact between the two, I mean, there was contact, but not all that great. So, you know, the world kind of centered in terms of the Bible on that particular part of the world. And of course, the Christian religion and the false religion that grew with it, both were concentrated in that area too. The false religion in Europe, basically. And of course, it spread around the world then as well. Somebody mentioned the possibility of different regions around the world being a part of these 10 kings. The fact is, you know, whatever happens, I'm not saying that couldn't happen, but whatever happens, Europe is such a major trading power that nations all over the world are tied into this system. So, you know, most countries in the world probably would, you know, go into this. And keep in mind, too, that right, you know, over the past 50 years, gradually we've all become better off. And a lot of that is to do with the American economic system. And it has given a lot of physical blessings to many of us around the world. And we've kind of developed along with the United States. If anything happened to the United States economically, if there was another depression, for example, the whole world then would be screaming, you know, and everybody would be looking for something, somebody, that would help get the world economy moving again. And Europe is the only possible engine that could do that, because the Europeans have the reserves. Japan is too tied into the American economic system, so it couldn't do it. Only Europe could do it. Somebody else raised their hand. Yeah. Yeah, I do. Well, I think one explanation as to why so many coins are the same in different parts of the world is because most countries don't make their own money. Switzerland prints a lot of the money and makes a lot of the coins of many nations. So does Britain. Most of the countries that Britain used to rule over still get their money from Britain. So, you know, like Ghana orders its currency from the Royal Mint in Wales, I believe it is, and gets its money from there. So there is a similarity between coins. Only the notes are changed because Obviously, they have to have different people on the notes and different colors and different name of the country is different. But, you know, it could be very convenient in creating, you know, one currency for everybody, certainly. I don't know why, when you said that, it reminded me of something else, too. Many of you may know this, and I'm sure many of you do know it, but now there's no such thing as a British passport, that you have a European passport now for all the countries in the European Union. And it's the color of burgundy. And the reason why they chose burgundy is because burgundy, which is this area in medieval times, was where the idea of resurrecting the Roman Empire started. And the Dukes of Burgundy were the ancestors of the Habsburgs who ruled this area right up until 1918. So that's the reason why the color is burgundy. How many of you have a European passport?